Actually, I wonder if you have ever considered how influential that you are as a woman and the powers that we have as women. Now, if you've ever argued with your husband on this subject, I want to give you a few things that will kind of add up on the woman's side. But actually, as you look around the world, wherever moral darkness holds sway, woman is always the victim. Woman's standard is always the unfailing moral thermometer, the planet around. Every great man attributes a large portion of his success to a woman, a mother, a grandmother, a wife, a sister, or even perhaps a daughter. She has influenced man, as in turn he has shaped events. Man has made history, but woman has made the man. The man is built for strength, and woman too, but for a far more delicate task. She has been given the greatest task entrusted into human hands, that of shaping a human life while it's in its most impressionable stage. However, before we can use our powers as women properly, we have to be women of contentment and of goals and of a purpose. And when we think in terms of the turbulent times in which we live, really the most exciting time to be alive, never has civilization been challenged with greater goals to be achieved. And as you think in terms of some of the things that we as women face, our world faces today, in the last 10 years, illegitimacy has increased 300%. Pornography has become a $500 million a year business. Gambling is a $20 billion a year racket. Crime is increasing four times faster than our population. And our crime bill is now over $20 million a year. Our nation has 5 million alcoholics and 3.5 million problem drinkers, many of whom are women. Today, over 60% of our population, 16 years and older, drink. Our divorce rate is 1 in 4 marriages ending in divorce. Some authorities claim it to be 1 in 3, and in Los Angeles County, it's 1 in 2.5. Venereal disease has increased 72% in this last year. Our culture is sex-obsessed, and the result is that our young people are becoming sex-obsessed. Premarital pregnancy is now involved in 85% of all marriages in which both parties are high school students. Girl wants boy, boy wants sex, so they get together on that basis. Dr. Bell has made an analysis that I think is very correct today, that modern man is turning from the authority of the Bible to human authority. Man no longer asks, what is God's will, but what do I think is best for me? We are in the midst of a crisis, a moral crisis, because the great majority of Americans who want to try to live moral lives no longer can be certain of what is right and of what is wrong. Most Americans hate to admit that we're in a crisis, but its bitter fruits are all around us. The beatnik, the racist, the wild kid, the price-rigging executive, the pregnant high school girl, the dope addict, the vandal, the bribed athlete, the uncared-for aged, the poor, the criminal. And television depicts shoot-em-up violence as the American way, and movies uphold stardom as a warrant for four husbands and a lover. Governor George Romney of Michigan has said that our greatest danger is the decline in religious conviction and moral character. This is more serious to our future than external threats that we face. It's reached a level that should be of great concern. It would appear that there's an organized conspiracy to break down the moral fiber when movies, magazines, TV, and all kinds of reports are given to make experimental sex popular. And as a result, our moral values have become blurred. Sex, which should be deeply serious and sacramental in the marriage relationship, is becoming casual and meaningless. Dr. J.D. Unwin of Cambridge University, who has made a study of civilizations ranging over a period of 4,000 years, has concluded that a society either chooses sexual promiscuity and decline, or sexual discipline, which produces a surge of creative energy. The fall of the Roman Empire, one of the greatest civilizations of all time, is attributed largely to the moral decay of her women. What our civilization is today, our home life yesterday had made it so. And our greatest influence in the world is still as a wife and a mother. Homemakers, you hold the key to what our civilization in the next generation is going to be. For instance, this time last year, the women of Brazil were largely responsible for stopping the planned communist takeover. The wide thoroughfares of downtown São Paulo were jammed with what the women called the March of the Family with God toward freedom. They threatened to flood the airport runways with women if the communist leaders tried to land. And the communists were defeated. Many of our leaders are saying that unless something dramatic happens to turn the tide of secularism and materialism and communism, that our civilization is doomed. Our freedoms are lost and our very existence is at stake. I believe that something significant can happen if enough people are awakened to their need of God and do something about it. Now you today say, yes, this is all well and good. I'm awakened. I well know the problem. But what can I do about it? I'm just a housewife. It can mention to you that I had majored in home economics. My pet peeve is that of saying, I'm just a housewife. Who wants to be a wife to a house? But be a homemaker. It makes a lot of difference how you look at it. One of the women that I have admired so tremendously through the years and have watched her closely and whose children are very good friends and tried very much, even which has had a great influence in my life, particularly as a mother, is Mrs. Lewis H. Evans. And her daughter gave me this illustration one time that she had come home from school at along about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and Mrs. Evans always tried to be her best when the children came home, but the time had gotten away from her, and she was sitting on the back step with her head in her hands. And this particular time, she was beating rugs. Isn't it marvelous we don't have to beat rugs anymore? But she was very weary. And before Mrs. Evans realized it, Marilee had caught her looking very, very tired. And Marilee said, Mother, I'm so sorry that you have to work so hard and that you have to be a housewife. And Mrs. Evans perked up real quickly and she says, My dear, I am not a housewife. I am building a home, and it takes lots of washing of dishes, lots of preparing of meals, lots of beating of rugs to build a home. And our whole attitude toward what God has given us as our ministry makes a great deal of difference of our happiness. You know, Mrs. Luther rocked a Reformation in her cradle, and we have no idea what God is going to bring about in the little lives in whom our lives will influence as a mother, a grandmother, an aunt, a sister, whatever. But God, know God's calling for you to be a woman of purpose and of gold. Know His calling for you now, with the assurance that the now is likely to change to something else. It isn't always God's will that we be changing diapers and doing the daily dozen. Pretty soon these little ones will be completely out from under our control, and then God has a different ministry for us. I think that's one of the exciting things about being a woman, that we don't, just about the time we get content in one situation, then long is changed, and it's a new challenge of becoming content in another, perhaps. Now let's look at some of the things that keep us from being really forceful for God. For a number of months, several years ago, I thought I was plagued with something that was very unique. You know, we always think that our problems are those that no one else ever has. And the one that plagued me was that of fear. You know, it's not exactly the most respectable problem to have. And we're not so prone to seek counsel for it, or even to confess to another person that we are afraid of this thing or that. But just about the time I was beginning to come out of this fear, or that God was giving me victory over it, then I began to think, well, what does the Bible have to say about fear? And I was astounded at the amount of material that the Bible has, the number of scriptures that are related to fear and how it affects our individual lives. It's a tremendous subject, and I would encourage you someday to perhaps do a study, a word study in the scriptures on fear. Actually, fear by definition is anxiety or dread of that which is not known, that we have no understanding of, and we fear that which we don't know anything about. I have a friend that doesn't like to fly, and flying with her, she'll say, listen to those motors. That doesn't sound right to me. You ever heard that plane sound like that? Well, you know, it never occurred to me to listen to how the motors sound or whether this was regularly normally. I just get on the plane. I only think about the plane. If I tried to understand it, I would be a nervous wreck unless I took a course in aviation or something of the sort. Now then, I think we just have to ask God to remove some of these things from us. But psychologically, fear is one of the greatest afflictions that can come to a person. It cripples the mind. We can't think clearly. We can't use our potential. It creates panic within the personality, a hysteria. It elevates the blood pressure. It affects the heart. And all of the body is affected. The blood goes to the muscles, and the body reacts just as if you were running a race are exerting great physical exercise. It can even bring on a heart attack. Have you ever had the experience of waking in the middle of the night not knowing what had awakened you, and your old heart just beat? You're just sure if anybody's there, they'd absolutely know that you were awake because your heart's beating so fast. You might as well run a 10-mile race. Your body, your muscles, the tension, all the adrenaline in your body works just the same as if you were under tremendous physical pressure. Now, in the study of fear, to think in terms of the aspects of fear. You know, there is a fear that we're allowed to have, and it's the fear of God. In Deuteronomy 5:29, we're told, oh, that there were such a heart in them that they would fear me, and they would keep all of my commandments always, that it might be well with them and with their children forever. In 1 Samuel 12:24, only fear the Lord and serve him in truth with all your heart, for consider how great things he has done for you. In Joshua 24:14, fear the Lord and serve him in sincerity and in truth. To fear God is to respect him. It denotes an awesome reverence, an awesome faith. The fear of God is the definition of true religion in the Old Testament. It's the beginning of wisdom, we're told in Psalms 111:10. The secret of uprightness in Proverbs 8:13. It brings about the keeping of God's commandments in Ezekiel 12:13. It distinguishes the people in whom God takes pleasure. It's the only fear that we are allowed to have. Now, in the New Testament, a contrast is drawn between the spirit of bondage and the spirit of adoption. This fear is not absent. It helps us in controlling our Christian walk. It makes us conscious of the comfort of the Holy Spirit. It stimulates honest service. It causes us to make an effort after holiness. Paul exhorts us that our salvation be worked out and service rendered with anxious concern to avoid evil and to be acceptable to God. Now then, another fear that we have so many times is that of the fear of man, particularly a fear that keeps us from being forceful. The need for courage in service for God is repeatedly emphasized. In Joshua 1, 7, verses 7 and 9, we're told that only be thou strong and very courageous, that thou mayest observe to do according to all the law which Moses my servant commanded thee. Turn not from it to the right hand nor to the left, that thou mayest prosper wherever thou goest. And in verse 9, have not I commanded thee? Be strong and of good courage. Be not afraid, neither be thou dismayed, for the Lord thy God is with thee whithersoever thou goest. In Jeremiah 1:8, we're told to be not afraid of their faces, because I am with thee and will deliver thee, saith the Lord. Fear unfits us for duty. In Joshua 2:11, we're told that as soon as we had heard, our hearts did melt. There was no more courage in any man. And as soon as we hear of somebody's discouragement, how many times that affects us. Fear affects others. In Deuteronomy 28, I just have been thrilled with this verse over and over again, and I nearly flipped, as the college kids say, when I found this. And the officers shall speak further unto the people, and they shall say, what man is there that is fearful and faint-hearted? Let him go and return into his house, lest his brethren's heart faint as well as his heart. That when we are fearful and express it, it causes others to be fearful too. And then the fear of man is really a selfish fear. What will other people think? What will the neighbors think? What will happen to me? And one of the great fears that we have as women is that of social status, or of what others will think of me. The fear of man bringeth a snare. Now I realize as you are exposed to these materials that you are already have had thrust at you, and if you haven't found it already, in your packet there is a what's called a survey. And you're going to be shown how to use this survey. And I might as well confess to you a little bit, in that I'm very human, and the fears that you have, I very definitely have had. But when Bill came up with this questionnaire, it's called, on the college campus, I protested violently. I said, you're not going to make Jehovah's Witnesses out of our staff, going around asking people questions about what they think about this or that or the other thing. And I cried. You know, when we have no other defense, we always cry, don't we? And I just begged him, Bill, don't use that. And months passed by, and I was determined, okay, if the staff's going to use it, that's well and good, but not for me. And then we came to staff conference. And you know, the Lord has a way of speaking to you when you kind of get away from home surroundings, doesn't he? And all of a sudden, the Lord reminded me that I hadn't exactly been obedient to him. And I had a resentment about this survey. And so I decided that I better get busy and do something about it, that if the staff, this was for them to do, then in order to be able to train the staff, I was going to have to do it. And this particular year, we were in Santa Barbara for a staff training conference, and one day I slipped off when nobody would know where I was and wouldn't be able to find me, and I decided, well, all right, I'll take this questionnaire. And I went down to the train station, where I was just sure that there wouldn't be any staff members or anybody to see me, and I started in with the questionnaire. That afternoon, I met three Christian women. God was so good to give me all three Christians that were so impressed with the idea that somebody was dedicated enough to God that would do this. And it gave a tremendous opportunity to tell about what was happening in the ministry of Campus Crusade and so on. But to be obedient. So the same fears that you have against using some of these things, we as a staff have experienced too. But to realize that there are people that are so hungry for God, and we can be forceful, more forceful in our witness when we take the courage to be direct, to ask direct questions.
Have you ever made the wonderful discovery of knowing Christ personally? You'd like to, wouldn't you? And can you imagine being offended if two sharp, well-dressed women came to your door and said they were taking a survey in the neighborhood? You would really think, well, what is it that makes these people tick? These are certainly a different variety going door to door. And you have no qualms whatsoever about going for the Red Cross or the March of Dimes or something about the PTA. And yet when we attach it to something Christian or to do with God, then we become very, very fearful. Then most of our fears are emotional fears. Fear of being God's rejected. Oh, so many Christians are suffering from this. The first mention of fear in the Bible actually is connected with Adam's disobedience. His sin was followed by an awareness of God's displeasure and fear of his judgment in Genesis 3:10. Fear is itself part of sin's punishment. In Leviticus, we're told that the punishment for this individual would be to flee when there was no one pursuing you. In Deuteronomy 28, 25, and 66, that you will fear day and night and no assurance of thy life as part of God's judgment in the Old Testament. How marvelous to know that we can confess and God forgives and that we do not have this fear any longer. But you know the thing that happens so many, many times and many, many Christians, I'm sure my husband will be mentioning this more to you, is the fact that if I give my life really to Christ, then God might take away my children, that I'd be so dedicated that he'll test me to see whether I really am right, or I'm really as strong as I profess to be. Or your health. Oh boy, does the devil ever get to me on this one? I have suddenly reached an age where I have more aches and pains than I ever thought about having. And some of you will see a little black mark on my face in that I've just had a mole removed the last few days in that it's been bothering me. And then the other day it bled a little bit. And I called and the doctor put me on the emergency list. And then I began to feel all kinds of sensations around this mole. And I decided to better come off there in a hurry, lay conference or no, spot or no matter what. And yesterday as I went to him, I said, oh, doctor, couldn't we delay this till next week? He said, well, nothing could look worse than it does right now. And so it's gone. But you know, I have learned that we can have so many aches and pains for no reason whatsoever. But our imagination gets the best of us because we think there may be a cause. And we hear so much about, if you think you have cancer, by all means get to the doctor. By all means get to the doctor to have peace of mind. It's worth the $40 examination or whatever it is to know that there's nothing there. I've just recently had a complete checkup. And the doctor, I said after it was over laughingly, I said, you mean I have not one single excuse for all these aches and pains I'm having? And he said, no, Mrs. Bright, I'm afraid you don't. I suggest you get a few more hours rest. Or one doctor said to me, would you like me to give you a tranquilizer? And I said, no, thank you. If that's all that's wrong with me, I know the cure for that. But to realize that lots of times we suspicion things being wrong, and it trips us up. It causes us to have problems when there's no need for a problem. So find out if there's anything physically wrong. Then we have fears about finances. Will we be able to get these children through college? What if my husband dies? How will I be supported? What would I do? Not particularly trained for anything. Or of losing a husband to another woman. Christians don't bother about things like this, do they? Or terrible thoughts that continually plague us, that cause us to be afraid. And we think, oh, you couldn't dare talk with anybody about this because nobody'd really understand. You'd never tell anybody about it. Listen, go to God with it and ask him to show you if it's real. And if it's not, ask him to take it out of your thinking that you might absolutely be able to forget it. Then find out what the cause is. What is its source? Then take action if needs to be, and then forget it. Emotional fears manifest themselves in worry. And worry is the greatest sin that man can commit. And of course, this sin has to be confessed just as any other. Now, concern is different than worry. We have to be concerned about something before we can take action about it. A very wonderful doctor, when I was sharing with him one time about this, and he said, actually, a good doctor does not relieve a person completely of pain. Because if he is relieved completely of pain, he will take no action. And you've all heard the story of the native that the doctor put in a shot of Novocaine and was going to pull the tooth. And the patient got up and ran out. He says, no need to pull tooth. Pain all gone. Well, we know what happens as soon as the Novocaine leaves. But we are, of course, are a little more educated than that at this point. But we're just as bad many times. And that aspirin relieves the pain. So we take more aspirin rather than finding out what it is that is actually wrong. But recognize the source, find the cause, and make the remedy. Then we many times are fearful because of a difference in feeling. And we depend on our feelings so many times. Perhaps we've made a decision that you've begun to feel maybe is wrong. Someone has said, don't doubt in the dark what God has led you to do in the light. We have followed God's leading, and then an open door has closed, and we begin to think, maybe I misunderstood the Lord in the first place. Now, there are lots of things that can affect this. Dr. Bob Smith one time was telling about an engaged couple. The young man had come to him, to Dr. Smith, telling him that it was just he'd just done a terrible thing. Just before exams, he had proposed to this girl. And he was so much in love with her, he just knew that she was the one that God had for him. And they had agreed that during exams, they would not see each other. And that this was over a full week's period. And he said, now then, this full week is up, and I'm supposed to see her tomorrow. And Dr. Smith, I don't love her anymore. I'm just sure I don't love her. And Dr. Smith began to quiz the young man in terms of what actually he'd been doing in this week. And he had been averaging 3 and 4 hours sleep a night. And some nights he'd been up all night. And he was rather tired and exhausted. So in Dr. Smith's wisdom, he said, well, I tell you, son, you go to your room, and I suggest that you get a good night's rest. Sleep at least 12 to 14 hours. Can do tremendous things for you. But then you come back and talk with me. And so the young man did, and he had a full 12 hours rest and came back to Dr. Smith. And Dr. Smith said, well, now, how about it? And he said, oh, Dr. Smith, I just know I'm in love. She's the right girl. I can hardly wait to see her. And many times we allow our physical tiredness or some circumstance around us to make us think that perhaps we've made the wrong decision or to have great fear about it. Discouragement or depression brings about fear, particularly the fear of rejection. Now then, what better way could Satan have of attacking the servant of God except by putting him under a cloud to take away his certainty? And it's the fastest way to defeat a husband. Actually, it's through his wife. I often hear people say, well, you know, his wife is not really sympathetic with what he's doing, particularly as a Christian worker. Nothing makes me madder. Or, well, his wife is such and such. Now listen, rather than criticizing, it better be our job to pray for that individual, because Satan is really giving her a hard time. And far more can be accomplished by praying for the person than by saying she isn't in full sympathy with her husband's ministry. And the more active the husband in Christian work, the more strongly I feel that the devil works on the wife. Because it's the first place to defeat the husband. Now, fear is conquered by faith, we're told in the scriptures. In Psalm 46:2 and in Psalm 112:7, we're told, He shall not be afraid of evil tidings. His heart is fixed, trusting in the Lord. In Luke 22, verses 31 to 34 in the Amplified Version, we're told that about Peter, but I have prayed especially for you, Peter, Jesus says, that your own faith may not fail.
And when you yourself have turned again, strengthen and establish your brethren. And Simon Peter said to him, Lord, I'm not ready to go with you, or I am ready to go with you both to prison and to death. But Jesus said, I tell you, Peter, before a single cock shall crow this day, you will three times utterly deny that you know me. And Satan seeks to sift us as his own. Then in the Holy Spirit shall be our protector, we're told in Isaiah 19, the last part of the verse. But the Lord shall be unto thee an everlasting light, and thy God of glory. I have to confess to you today something that I have debated about telling you. I'm reading today from one of my prized possessions. This Bible that I'm reading from was one of Henrietta Mears, and one of the last ones that she used. And she was the individual that led me to Christ. And when I picked this up today, I found this verse underlined in several of the verses that I am reading to you. But the Lord shall be unto thee an everlasting light, and thy God thy glory. In Isaiah 51:12, we're told, I am he that comforteth you. Who art thou that thou shouldst be afraid of a man that shall die, and the son of man which shall be made as grass? In Ephesians 1:3, and again in Philippians 4:30, or in Ephesians 4:30, excuse me, the Holy Spirit cannot leave us. And this was one of the things that was such a great help to me, particularly in terms of feeling that I had was to be punished, or maybe that God was not pleased with what I had done. In that Ephesians 4:30 reads, And do not grieve the Holy Spirit of God. Do not offend or vex or sadden him, by whom you were sealed, marked, branded as God's own, secured for the day of redemption, of final deliverance through Christ from evil and the consequences of sin. God cannot and will not forsake us. There is a sin unto death, but it's only when a person does not care. When we realize that we are out of fellowship with God and take action to get back into fellowship, then we can be sure that this is not punishment from God. Then love casteth out all fear. The verse that I have claimed time and time again is 1 John 4:18, and again in the Amplified Version. There is no fear in love. Dread does not exist, but full-grown, complete, perfect love turns fear out of doors and expels every trace of terror. For fear brings it with it the thought of punishment, and so he who is afraid has not reached full maturity in love, is not yet grown love's complete perfection. In Hebrews 13:5, and if you're not familiar with this one, let me encourage you, it's worth the whole price of the Amplified New Testament. Let your character or moral disposition be free from the love of money, including greed, avarice, lust, and the craving for earthly possessions, and be satisfied with your present circumstances and with what you have. For he, God himself, has said, I will not in any way fail you, nor give you up, nor leave you without support. I will not, it says again, in any degree leave you helpless, nor forsake, nor let you down, relax my hold on you. Assuredly not. And in 1 Peter 5:7, again in the Amplified, all your anxieties, all your worries, all your concerns, once and for all on him. For he cares for you affectionately and cares about you watchfully. Let me encourage you. With your problems, go to God's word for your answer. It's all there. I would need not have suffered so much being fearful had I gone to God's word in the first place. But now then, how can we, in terms of we know overcoming fear with love, and that God is able to give us victory over these things, but how can we become militant or forceful in our, as Christian women? Some of the practical things that we might do in this business of, oh, I'm just a housewife, no longer, now I'm a homemaker. But one of the great things that we can do, of course, is to be militant in our Christian living. You know, a very dear friend of mine came back with a quote from India in criticism of Christians. The person had said, you know, Christians are quite ordinary people professing super ordinary powers. And many times we profess one thing, but we're living another. This is the great hindrance to people becoming Christians. Now then, in terms of our home, where we live, correcting those children, and all of your time here, not only do we tell you how to do things, but giving you materials and so on, but we really try to be as practical as can be to give you victory in your daily walk with Christ. And you will hear much about this during your time here, but we're talking about being forceful now in terms of your home and your neighborhood. But many of us, of course, are trying desperately to live the Christian life, and we're failing continually. It's getting to the place where we've gotten to the place where we don't dare open our mouths because we're afraid our lives don't back up what we say. And it's because we're trying in our own effort, in our own strength. And I would take you to these diagrams of my husband's. But to realize that when we give our lives completely to God and we are staying close to Him, He desires to live His life in and through us. It was so marvelous to me to know that God expected nothing from me but failure, and that He will live His life in and through me. Billy Graham recently told the story, and he called the man's name. I can't tell you who it was, but a very famous preacher. And this man was standing in a field, actually was plowing in a field, and he saw a circuit rider preacher go by on the road. The man was sitting on his horse, carrying his Bible. And just the force of that man's presence caused the man in the field to drop to his knees, knowing that the man of God had passed by. Not spoken a word, didn't even know the man. Would that God be so powerful in our lives that people around us, by just a look or a glance, can tell the difference. You know, in San Bernardino, because there are so many of us from here up here on the hill, and people have been very, very curious about Arrowhead Springs and so on, but they tell us. You know, the woman, one of the women at the bank, a Christian, says, we can tell the very moment someone from Campus Crusade or from Arrowhead Springs walks in the door of the bank. She says, you just don't know what a magnetic quality there is about your lives, because it's such a contrast, you see, to the Christian in the not. She says, you just, everything about you is so different. And we hear this time and time again. People, not long ago, well, just last week, one of the women was here that has just recently become a Christian, and she brought two of her friends. And one of the women that she brought said, you know, there is something about the look that all of you have up here that's just beautiful. She says, you don't fit anyplace else. Well, they're probably not looking. See, we're a little more concentrated in number here. That's the reason why they can kind of pinpoint it. But how marvelous that God can dwell in us in such a way that people can tell a difference. Use your homes for the Lord. And you say, well, how? By entertaining. Invite a couple in at a time. Perhaps you're in a church where you don't have very much really Christian fellowship. Divide and conquer. Invite couples to your home for dinner. Share with them the training that you have received. If they're responsive, then go on and on. Maybe they don't really know Christ. Maybe they know Christ, but they don't know anybody else that does, and here's a practically a dormant Christian. Or it may be that you will find tremendous fellowship with them. One of the women that was here for our conference not long ago, as we were talking about this, she says, you know, it never occurred to me that I could have groups in my home to hear a speaker. She said, our pastor isn't in agreement with some of the people that we ask to come to speak. And so he won't have them speak in the church, but she says, you know, I could invite them to my home. There's a group in Tyler, Texas that wanted to have a speaker come, and they couldn't find a pastor that would have him in their church, and so they decided that they would have a Christian cocktail party. Now, when I say cocktail, they didn't serve cocktails, but they sent engraved invitations, and they served hors d'oeuvres and everything else that you would serve at a cocktail party, a beautiful party. Everybody in Tyler turned out because they were afraid that somebody else wouldn't see them there and that they wouldn't have received an invitation. And here they were with everybody that was anybody, the city that would never, many of them never darkened the door of a church. But they came to the hotel and were thrilled to death with the invitation. And I think out of that group now there's something like 13 Bible studies going a week. It's just fabulous to see what God has done. And you know it isn't very expensive when a number of you as Christians go together to do such a thing. But do things as Christians in a way in which the world would do it, but better. It's just so exciting to see. Well, this summer, for instance, we had a reception for Jerome Hind here, a formal reception. It was just thrilling to see the way in which the people came. They thought, sure, there was going to be a band. In fact, some of them said, well, who's the band that's playing? But after they got here, they didn't even miss the band. And many of them said, we've never have spent a more wonderful evening. A different kind of a thing, but on the same caliber. Then in your church, don't leave the task of evangelism to your pastor. Poor guy, he has all he can do. He's just weighted down. But ask him for some of these cards of preferred people or people that have come to the church that need to be called on. And then as you go, don't go just inviting them to church, but talk with them about their personal relationship with Christ. One woman in Oklahoma City calling for her pastor called at this home, and as she talked with this woman about her personal relationship with Christ, and the woman indicated she wanted to receive Christ, she says, by the way, you know, you are the fourth person that has come from the First Baptist Church of Oklahoma City to call in my home. But she said, not any of them ever talked with me about my relationship with Christ. And the woman received Christ, and she was in church on Sunday morning. And this is the difference. Lots of times people are really embarrassed to go to church because they feel like they're going to be put under pressure to go forward. Or as the pastor gives a message, there is a tug at their heart and they feel like they would be conspicuous by making a stand, and so they won't do it. But when you talk with them personally, and then you personally take them, and after they have received Christ, then they're ready to make a public commitment of their faith. And many times the reason that we're not seeing people come to Christ in our churches is because they're just not Christians, non-Christians there. We're not going to them. Many of us don't even have non-Christian friends that we can invite. Many times non-Christian friends come into the church, but we're so busy visiting with Christians we don't even seek them out to introduce ourselves or to make them friendly, make ourselves friendly. You know, one of the most things that impressed me as a non-Christian were the things that were held in the college department at Hollywood Presbyterian Church, and that the young people got together to sing after church, and they had a marvelous time. It was just fabulous. The fellowship, I'd never seen anything like it. They all just loved each other. Never seen anything like this anyplace else, and I was impressed with what I saw. And that if we can show people that Christians really have a good time. We're not fuddy-duddies sitting off reading our Bibles all the time, or that you can't do this and you can't do that and you can't do something else. But that we have something so much more wonderful and positive to take its place. Then, in terms of what you can do in your church, pass on to others the training that you have received. If there are those that have a real heart for the Lord, then begin to go together, calling in the neighborhood or on these preferred contexts. Dr. and Mrs. Fred Smith, and perhaps some of you read the story of Dr. Fred Smith with cancer, that his story was carried in Decision Magazine, and the way in which God took or chose to take this man home is just a precious, precious story. But Dr. and Mrs. Smith, here he is, one of the five top biochemists in the world, and one of three, I think, in the United States, something like this. And they decided they wanted their lives to count for God. And they began to analyze what they could do, so they decided with a group of their Christian friends that they would have a Bible study in their home, an evangelistic Bible study, on Wednesday night. And here people came, they never had less than 20, sometimes 60, 80, I don't know how many more, but I know at least that many. Their house just crowded out. And here were these, I think there were three couples at first that started this.
They were all trained in terms of talking with people personally afterward. They were going around after the meeting with those that were not, that they knew not to be Christians, and asking them if they'd made the wonderful discovery of knowing Christ and helping them and so on. Many of them were finding Christ. One Sunday we were at their home for dinner with their pastor, and I had forgotten that the pastor was there, and I asked the question, well, because we have a policy in Campus Crusade that we don't do anything that conflicts with the church. And I said, why is it that you have this Bible study on Wednesday night? And Mrs. Smith spoke up and she says, well, it's very simple. If we had it any other night of the week, we'd have so many Christians here that the non-Christians, there wouldn't be room for the non-Christians. And the pastor spoke up and he said, I wish that I had more people that were interested in seeing people one to Christ enough so they wouldn't need to be in prayer meeting on Wednesday night if they were doing something like this. And the membership of that church was increased tremendously, we can assure you, because of the way that these couples were getting together. But they were thinking strategically, and they didn't want to exclude Christians, but they had it on Wednesday night so Christians would be at prayer meeting and they could have the non-Christians come to their home. And the pastor was backing them up. Then to think in terms of organizing in a way, think strategically about your neighborhood and the way in which you can use what God has given you. One of the things that the Methodist Church is encouraging in their evangelism department is organizing coffee hours. I was talking with a pastor's wife just on Sunday about this. And they're encouraging the people to get coffee hours together in the neighborhood to have their non-Christian friends to come in. Now then, the important thing is that you know what to share, that you have something to tell them. It isn't enough to just get them together, but that you bring them with a real purpose. And then you can very easily share what is involved for a tea or for a luncheon. And to think of having a number of Christians that know what to do, and maybe it may be that you're the only one. Actually, one of the lay wives that has come for training was here last February, and then we saw them again in Atlanta. Actually, a doctor and his wife from Indianapolis. And so she went with Barbara Ball to one of her teas that she had in Atlanta. And she heard Barbara give her testimony, and she saw what the hostess did and so on. She says, hey, this is all you do, and you see such wonderful results. And she said, well, I could give my testimony and give the four laws. And so she went home and invited 40 of her friends. She'd never been able to really tell what it meant to be a Christian before. She invited them into her home. Then she simply got up and gave her testimony, included the four laws. And she saw 7 women that afternoon receive Christ as their personal Savior because she knew what to say and what to do. And wouldn't you be impressed with one of your friends that loved you enough, that had called you to their home, and had asked you or wanted to share with you that which was the most meaningful thing in the world to them? And of course, if they're looking, then they're ready not to poke it down their throats, but this we want to share. A friend of mine that lives in La Jolla, you know, we don't have a great deal of this world's goods, but we enjoy an awful lot. And God has really blessed us. I thought that we were singularly blessed in this way too. And many times I've said we have more and we have less and enjoy more than anybody alive. And then I found out that Paul said exactly the same thing. But lots of times we don't have much, but we have friends that have lots that we can really use in the right way. We can work together with them, making an impact. And this friend in La Jolla, and we have to be careful in how you say this. I don't want you to misinterpret what I say, but occasionally we have what's called a show-off luncheon. And I mean this in the very best sense, but there are people of the world that are not impressed by mediocrity. Now, lots of times they are. I'll never forget one of the most outstanding laymen in the United States today found the Lord in our home, but the thing that impressed him was that I had given him a piece of hot gingerbread and milk, and nobody had ever served that to him any time. That all he'd been so accustomed to people giving him alcohol, or that they're impressed with your dedication and your modest surroundings. Don't be afraid to use whatever it is that God has given you to his honor and his glory. But in this particular time, we had this luncheon that we laughingly to ourselves called a show-off luncheon, and that we invited other Christians that had beautiful mink stoles. And one of my friends, actually the wife of the woman I just mentioned with the gingerbread and milk, I called her and I said, I'd like for you to drive your new Cadillac. It happened to be a custom Cadillac, and I want you to park it at the mailbox. And she said, oh, Vonetta, I'd be scared to death to drive that car. If I put a dent in that car, I hate to think of what my husband would say. I'd never even driven it. And I said, oh, please drive it for this occasion and put it
at the mailbox. And as we came to the luncheon, and everything was just lovely, it was just beautiful. And I set the person that I was really trying to reach for Christ, had talked with her many times, and actually the person from La Jolla had brought her friends, and we had two here that were really trying to show that being a Christian was positive, and that you didn't have to just give up everything when you came to know the Lord. And so we seated them strategically. And you know who mentioned the Cadillac? Not another person at the table said a word about the Cadillac. Didn't mean a thing to anybody else that was there. But my friend was seated across the table, and she said, when she came in, "Well, whose beautiful orchid chariot is that sitting down by the mailbox?" And she was mighty impressed, let me tell you, in terms of what people had. Now, it means nothing as far as the Lord is concerned. We know it means nothing. But I wish you could see that woman now. She's using her beautiful beach home, just a gorgeous showplace, for playing tapes for people to come to hear the gospel that would never go to church. Her husband has built a beautiful, beautiful prayer chapel at a conference grounds nearby. And she is militant in her Christian life for Christ. Both of these women, actually, are very outstanding Christians today. But it was the Lord used material things to get them interested. And now then, they mean nothing, or they're using them for His honor and glory. Then let me encourage you to become active in one secular organization. A friend of mine not long ago said, when we were trying to get a group together, or had encouraged her to get a group together for tea in her home, she said, "Well, listen, Vonette, my non-Christian friends left me a long time ago." And she says, "Now my carnal ones are leaving me." And she just didn't know any non-Christians. And this is many times true. We're so active in our churches, which is wonderful. But we're not having an outreach with non-Christians. And I would encourage you to become active, not in a lot of secular things, but one secular organization. The PTA, the Women's Club, the League of Women Voters, whatever it might be. That you might have contact with non-Christians, and that you might invite them into your church and to get them together in other Christian groups. In politics, oh, how I'm appalled at the way in which, you know, people have so little sense many times in terms of they're so gullible. And anybody that will stand up, because they will stand up before a group, they will swallow hook, line, and sinker everything that they say. And unless we as Christians have a little bit of discernment and can add a little bit of salt into this, all that's going on, heaven help us. But we have drawn our skirts so closely about us so many times, and we have no non-Christian context. So I would encourage you to use the influence that you have for the Lord. There were three men in an organization that decided, actually it was a Kiwanis or a Rotary or something, it doesn't make any difference what the club was, a service club, and they had decided that it had been long enough that they had been hearing all of these terrible jokes that were given. And so they agreed together that one of them would stand up in their next meeting and would say, one would get up and say, I make a motion that we inform our speakers from now on that we are men of integrity, and that we really would prefer that they not use any profanity, that they not tell dirty stories, and that they would really, in their talks, give us something that would edify us as men. And so it was agreed that the second man would stand and say, "Well, I have been waiting for somebody to have the courage to do this." And then it was agreed that a third man would stand in another section of the room and say, "Well, I want to third that motion." And you know, it was carried unanimously, and the men didn't really know what hit them. Now, this is the way the secular world does things. And we as Christians should be as organized in terms of letting our influence be felt wherever we are. In 2 Timothy 1:7, and while you're here, you will receive a letter, it's probably in your packet, called the Paul Brown Letter on the Sound Mind Principle. And it's basically taken from this. In terms of thinking strategically, what is it that God has given us? How can we use it? What is my position of influence? And in 2 Timothy 1:7, we're told, "For God give us a spirit of timidity, of cowardice, of craven and clinging to frowning fear, but He gave us a spirit of power and of love and of calm and well-balanced mind and discipline
and self-control. God help us to use that which He has given us to His honor and glory.